during the week, the MEP Brian Crowley has announced that he will not run in the upcoming European elections in May after being elected to the position five times for the Ireland South constituency. He has been unable to attend any Parliament sitting since his re-election in 2014 due to ill health. He has spent much of the last 3 years and a half in a hospital bed. He joins me now from Cork, and you're very welcome indeed to the programme. 3.5 years in hospital is a long time. Brian, why did you have to spend so much time there?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Marion, for having me on the programme, and a good morning to everybody. I had to spend 3.5 years because I had wounds on my hips and my thighs that wouldn't heal. So the solution was do surgery, try a surgical procedure, which would either be a skin graft or maybe a muscle movement or whatever else to try and see if they could heal the wound and allow it to rejuvenate itself. Unfortunately, that didn't work.
And what caused the wound?
Well, as people may, well, maybe not everybody knows, but as some people may know, in 1980, I fell from the roof of a building and I broke my back and I'm paralysed with my hips down.
Yes.
And as a consequence of that paralysis, there's a lot of things you can't do, obviously. Now, I hate saying you can't do because I never think that way, but, you know, obviously you can't walk, you can't get up and run around the place or whatever else. But also, because you're not using your legs and because you don't have the same mobility within your lower limbs, there's an issue with regard to circulation, with regard to muscle tone, bone density, skin density, etc. So again, these are not exact figures, so I'm only giving this as an analogy. Say that you, for instance, that your skin would generate 1,000 skin cells every day.
Right.
So you know the way some people, your skin flakes at night in the bed and you have to shake it out or whatever, and there's new skin cells out growing on that. Well, one of the difficulties when you're paralysed is that you don't have that same regeneration. So instead of 1,000 skin cells, there might only be 300 skin cells. So the skin is getting thinner and thinner and thinner. So if you can imagine having...
It's interesting, yeah.
If you can imagine a comparison between a napkin that you use sitting at a dining table, like a linen napkin that's handmade, and compare that to a tissue that you use to blow your nose. And
right.
the density of both of those, that's the sort of comparison.
Right. And is that inevitable, Brian?
It's not inevitable, but it happens very frequently and very regularly with people who have disabilities. And because you have no feeling, because you can't immediately recognise that there is a problem. I mean, for instance, if you cut your finger, you can see blood, you can see a cut, you can feel the pain. Whereas because you have no sensation or feeling, I don't have any sensation or feeling from my hips down, that I could cut my leg and not recognise that it's cut until sometimes the blood starts to come out, at which stage it may have festered internally underneath the skin. And that was part of the problem, that the wound was actually festering under the skin before it actually broke out. So when it actually broke out on top of the skin and I went to get it treated, it was actually far more serious than I recognised or than I realised originally.
Right.
And I mean, my decision was after the election in 2014, I decided, look, I'll go into hospital on June 2014 after the election, get the surgery, recover, resolve, get out, get back to work in September. Job is OXO. And because that's what happened previously, and I was able to do that previously when I had previous sores prior to 2014. I was on your programme, sorry, you weren't doing it at the time, just Charlie Bird was doing it after another bout in hospital that time to explain what it was, a similar thing. So that worked previously, so I thought it would work now. Unfortunately, it didn't work this time. And after 2 weeks after the initial surgery, everything was going great and suddenly the wound broke down again. So they had to wait another 2 weeks for them to do more surgery. And then everything went great after that again. After 3 weeks, the wound broke down again. They had to wait another 2 weeks. And this cycle went on for 36 or 37, I can't remember exactly how many, surgeries, and which required me to lie in bed after every surgery to allow for recovery. And then when it didn't recover, to wait and build up again to start for the next surgery. And that's why I was 3.5 years lying down in bed.
I gather this is your own description. My legs, my hips and my thighs are like a relief map of Ireland from before the Ice Age.
Well, that's it. Because the simplest surgery is you stitch a wound together. That's the simplest part. So if you have a cut, you put in stitches, bring the skin together, it heals. That's the simplest. The next thing is to do a skin graft, whereby you take a piece of skin from your thigh or your calf or whatever, and put it over the wound and hope that will heal. Then the next thing you do is you do what's called fat injections, where you take liposuction fat out of your tummy and inject it into the wound, and hopefully that will bulk it up. The next one then is muscle manipulation or muscle flaps, whereby they move muscles. So for instance, my calf muscles, my hamstrings, my thigh muscles, my knee muscles, my hip muscles have all been moved to try and fill up gaps where the wounds were, to try and give them bulk. But every time you do that, you stitch. Every time you do that, you must sew up the other existing wound. And suddenly, you know, with every wound, there's a scar. But these are fairly significant scars because they're deeper and they're wider or whatever else. And that's why I'm saying it's like a relief map. You know, but people may say, oh, that's desperate or whatever. And it is. I mean, it was horrible to go through it. Don't get me wrong. But there's people going through an awful lot worse. People suffering an awful lot more. And, you know, who have to go through so much more difficulty. And I know people that are, I mean, my situation now is that I still have an open wound that has to be managed. I have to change a dressing every second day. Once a month, I go back into the hospital to see the wound management specialist nurses to make sure I'm doing the right thing.
So it's management from here on in rather than a hope for a cure?
There doesn't appear to be any surgical solution at the moment. After all the other surgeries, there doesn't appear to be any further surgical solution.
And what kind of danger of infection, therefore, is there?
Well, you have an open wound, so there's always a huge risk of infection, and that it can get very bad. And I mean, and the biggest danger with infection is not so much the infection itself, but it could turn gangrenous, and that creates its own problem.
Is it true you asked them at one stage to amputate your legs?
Yes. Sorry, originally, when this problem started for me back in 2009, 2010, it was in my lower limbs, it was down in my ankles where the problem was. And despite, again, having several surgeries on my ankles to try and solve that problem, it didn't heal. And my solution was, look, I'm not going to be walking around again. I'm 36 years in a wheelchair. It's not like I'm going to be getting up and running around playing for Munster against Exeter tonight or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, much as Peter Manny would like me to replace him. But from a practicality point of view, if this could solve the problem and stop a wound from developing, why not? No, in fairness.
What did they say?
They said no, because they said that may not be a solution. You could create another wound where the amputation takes place.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And obviously they were right as well, because what actually happened is that the next wound I got was on my knee, which was higher up. And the when I was in hospital most recently, the wounds were on my hips and my upper thighs. So, you know, having an amputation at the ankle or below, just above the foot, wouldn't then necessitate having an amputation above the knee, which would then necessitate below the hip, and suddenly there's no more to amputate after that. You know what I mean? So they were right. And again, in my blissful ignorance, I suppose is what you'd call it, I saw that as an immediate solution, because I wanted a practical, quick solution that would get me out and back.
And how do you keep your spirits up?
Well, I mean, it's easy, because my life is great. I people think it's desperate, but every day you have to live, you have a great life. Every day you can breathe in there and see the sun and
yeah,
meet people.
Yeah, I think that's a very nice thing to say. But lying there with wounds that won't heal indefinitely, going over and over and over, is at the very least wearing.
I suppose, again, in one sense, I'm a naive optimist. I always thought the next surgery, the next operation would be the one that would solve the problem. I honestly believed every single time I went for surgery, I thought, this is it. I'm out of here. This is going to work. And unfortunately, it didn't. But I never lost hope. I never lost belief. And I mean, on top of the support of my family, my friends and so on, I have great faith in, as people will know, I have great faith and devotion to Our Lady.
Yeah.
And that's always been part of my life. And what the great thing about that part of my life is that gives me the strength to accept whatever happens and to get on.
Yep, fair enough. And I mean, that's the right thing to do. But I would have thought maybe easier said than done. But I know that great faith can be great sustenance for people.
Exactly. And again, I mean, you know, as I said, those people have gone through an awful lot worse than I have and can maintain inspirational understanding and acceptance of whatever lot is put before them. I was listening to your programme a number of weeks ago, and Olive Foley was with Sister Helen. And I mean, everything Olive Foley and Sister Helen said, I could relate to. Right. I could understand it and say, yeah, that's the way I feel as well. That's how I look at things. That's what works for me.
Yeah. She was...
She was phenomenal. I mean, and again, what she's had to go through and what her children have to go through is a billion times worse.
To remind people, this is Anthony Foley's widow.
That's
just
correct.
Just in case they might have forgotten, which I'm sure they haven't.
The former Munster captain and Munster coach.
Indeed,
who died suddenly in Paris before a match against Racing Metro. Racing.
Yeah.
In Paris. Racing 92.
The notion about your faith and your religion and your commitment to Our Lady, as we were going through, because you had, as it were, stepped back from the public eye, as we went through various referenda, including abortion and marriage equality, how did you view those?
Well, first of all, the reason I stepped back from public life was because I had promised any journalist that contacted me or my office that when I got out of hospital and when I was able to, I would answer all their questions directly myself.
Right.
And I didn't want to do it piecemeal, if you know what I'm saying, bit by bit and respond and react to every single little thing. No, I didn't think that it would take as long to do what I did. And again, I deeply respect the courtesy shown to me by the journalistic profession in allowing me to do that. And I know it was difficult and very hard for them at times to bite their tongues or to hold their pens with regard to some of the stuff they could have written. But I mean, with regard to the referendums that took place, I personally, on the repeals issue, I would have voted against. I would have been against repeal.
Yeah.
That's not making a judgment in what anybody does or what anybody else believes. I just think that we should try everything possible to save life rather than take life. And I can understand we've the story in the paper today about that poor lady in the Coombe Hospital and what she's going through. And I mean, you know, nobody can fully understand what it's like for a family to go through that until the time they've gone through it themselves. And I can't. I there's nothing in my life that I can say makes me understand why or what the situation was.
Right.
But I mean, my philosophy is very simple. A life is better to keep rather than to take. And I mean, that's why back in 1996, I voted in favour of ensuring that the death penalty was never going to be allowed to be take place in Ireland again. And that was put into the constitution. We could never introduce the death penalty in Ireland. And you know, again, it's a simple thing. I've seen too many people whose lives have been lost either through illness, through accidents or through neglect or whatever else. And that everybody that I saw who was near death wanted to live.
Yeah.
I never saw anybody who wanted to die. So, I mean, I would have campaigned.
Well, you sometimes do, but we won't go down that road.
I know. Yeah. Again, I can't. For me, I can't relate to somebody who thinks they want to die. But that's me, and I could be wrong. my opinion and my philosophy could be wrong, and I'm quite open that I could be wrong. But you know, if I didn't have that belief myself, if I didn't have a belief that life is important and precious, if I didn't have a belief that there is life after life, whatever that is, it would be very difficult to live this particular life.
Okay, and on the marriage equality?
And the marriage equality, again, I mean, I have no problem with letting people live their lives whatever way they wish to live.
Okay.
I personally didn't think it was necessary to put it into the Constitution. You could have put legislation in place that would allow for that to take place because, same with the children's rights referendum and when the children's rights referendum went forward, I felt that didn't need to be in the Constitution, that children, the same as me or you or anybody else, are human beings. The human rights and protections within our Constitution cover all people, regardless of age, disability, colour, creed or religion.
Yeah, mind you, that had been following on from some pretty horrendous stories. Now, I'm just looking at the screen filling up here, and naturally enough, politics come into it. Let me read a couple to you. Why didn't he resign at any time over the last 4.5 years? That's from somebody in Limerick. Marion, great to hear, Brian. Huge loss to our politics. Really genuine guy. Get well, Brian. Hope you come back on the national stage. That's from Dublin. Another caller. He's a nice guy who had a lot of support, but why doesn't he resign on medical grounds and let someone with more energy and less distraction take over? Or is the role of an MEP so ineffectual that it just doesn't matter if the incumbent is unable to perform? Now, that inevitably was going to come up.
Of course.
You had been sick the previous 2 years. You had told the electorate that you had been unwell when you were running.
Yes.
But it's nearly 6 years, you could say, on the trot that you have been unable to go, which I know you really want to go to work. But it's a long time.
Sorry, no, Maren. The previous 2 years, I was only missing for gaps within those 2 years.
Okay.
From a month and a half or 2 months or whatever between times. So it wasn't a permanent 2 years out, the same as this time, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So that it wasn't there at all. I mean, it was there. And again, if you look back over my record since 1994, when I was first elected to the European Parliament, I was in the top 4% of people in attendance, in voting and in participation within debates within the Parliament since 1994. It's only in the last term, this present term, that because I haven't been there, so therefore, how can you register if you're not there? It's a legitimate question for people to ask. Why don't you resign? I mean, first of all, I believe that I went to the people looking for a mandate, openly and honestly, and explained fully. I never hid that this could be a problem in the future.
Right.
I never denied that I could have had an ongoing problem. I never denied that I had a problem previously and what I had to go through to solve it and deal with it. So, I mean, from that prospect, I don't think I did anything wrong. And again, you know, look at the record when people voted for me. They voted for me in big numbers and that, you know, they felt that I had something to offer as well. Whilst I was in hospital, I was still able to work remotely. I was still able to put on amendments to reports within committees. I was still able to put questions to the Commission and to the Council. I arranged meetings and delegation visits for people, for individuals, for party colleagues from Fianna Fáil to go to Brussels to meet commissioners, to meet officials within the Parliament, within the Council, within different embassies, to help them in their solutions and their problems. My staff in my office in Cork and in my other offices have been working full-time all the time, and indeed there's been no diminution in the amount of work coming to my office in the last 3 years than there was in the previous 10 years.
I'm sure, but are you saying that actually showing up in Parliament and debating and meeting with your colleagues is not relevant or important?
It is very, very important, because you have to be there to vote and so on, of course. But over the past 25 years, I've built up a lot of contacts and a lot of support from people in different institutions. So when you talk about meeting people in corridors and doing discussions, I can pick up the phone and I can ring 1,000 people in Brussels, whether they're in the Commission or the Council or the Parliament or whatever else, from different political parties, from different nationalities.
I appreciate that. So you actually think attendance is not relevant at all?
No, I do think attendance is relevant. I do. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm saying that I physically couldn't be there.
Of course.
For those periods of time.
Yeah.
It is relevant, yes. And I will be there in February, March and April. And I hope that people will recognise that I will be there in February, March and April.
Why are you going in February, March and April?
Because I'm finishing off my term. I'm out of hospital now. I'm released from doctor's orders. I'm able to go back and do it in a certain way.
Right, okay.
Previously I was lying in bed in hospital. They wouldn't physically allow me out of bed, so I couldn't actually get to a wheelchair or go to an airport or whatever else.
Well, of course, everybody understands that. But I saw a quote from Luke Ming Flanagan, who, you know, was sympathetic to your situation, but he was saying he would resign as an MEP if he was in that situation, because being present for votes in the Parliament was an essential element of an MEP's job.
It is part of it, yes, but it's in a sense, very, very important part of it. And I'm sure Luke being Flanagan has 100% record of voting in the Parliament.
Referring to the fact that he actually had to take 3 months off when his own wife was unwell, but he said any bit more than that he had taken, he'd have lost momentum and he'd have lost his role.
Well, that's because Luke Ming Flanagan was a first-time MEP. I've been there for the last 25 years. I've the contacts built up the same way that he has now built up contacts over the last 5 years and has built up relationships with different people on the committees that he's on and so on that he can cooperate with. I have 25 years of experience already behind me in dealing with those things.
So basically, you're saying it just doesn't really affect your performance at all.
It does. I mean, this is not the way I want to do my job. This was not the way that I was doing my job previously.
Right.
When I started off first back in 1994, I was an innocent, naive, unaware of how Europe actually worked when I went out there first, and took me a while to get the hang of it. And if it wasn't for my old friend Mark Hilliday, God rest him, who passed away recently.
That's right.
If he wasn't there to guide me, I mean, Mark Hilliday is like a second father to me. And, you know, I know a lot of people, and if I may just have a moment to say, Mark Hilliday was one of the greatest Irishmen ever in what he delivered in Europe for Irish people. I never got the credit for it in the sense of the way people get credit as, oh, what a phenomenal legislator he or she is or whatever else, but delivered in real terms. And whether somebody was a pauper or somebody was a king, they were treated the exact same by Mark Hilliday, and they treated Mark Hilliday
right.
the exact same.
Well, that, one would hope so.
And that's one of my greatest,
yeah.
one of the greatest problems that I've been unwell and unable to get out and about. I couldn't go to Mark Hilliday's funeral recently
right.
when he was buried. And I couldn't be with his family to share with them because
right.
they're like my brothers and sisters as well. Likewise, I couldn't go to the funeral of the lady who was the first person to nominate me for stand for election back in 1984, who died 2 years ago from motor neurons disease. Or I couldn't go to Albert Reynolds' funeral, who was the first person to appoint me to the Senate and to give me my start in politics. And hundreds of other friends and colleagues and supporters of mine whom I couldn't be with in their moments of grief.
Right. Well, I'm sure they would appreciate that very, very much. Now, coming back to the political world, tell me about your relationship with Micheál Martin. When was the last time you spoke to him?
If you'd asked me that question yesterday, I would have said July 2014. But I actually met him at a function yesterday in Cork.
Oh, there you go. Up to that, it was July...
2014. Yeah.
Why the gap?
Well, I mean, after I was elected, in the European Parliament, after every election, the political groups within the Parliament had to be reconstituted. And even though the groups are there for decades, they still have to be reconstituted after every election because you have new members elected and whatever else. So I was in negotiation with the ALDE group, to which Fianna Fáil are aligned, as regards rejoining that group. But my problem was that there was a number of Irish staff who didn't work for me personally, but who were Irish people who previously worked in the group that I was president of, in the UEN group in the previous parliament, and that they were transferred over to the Liberal group when Fianna Fáil joined the Liberal group. And they were supposed to be guaranteed jobs within that group, but the ALDE group refused to live up to their promise of guarantees. So I was negotiating with the leader of the Liberal group, Guy Verhofstadt, and the Secretary General Alexander Beals between June and July, and I was keeping Micheál Martin informed of what was going on and what the difficulty was and so on, and up to the very end the Liberal group refused to give the contracts to people or to give them any sustenance whatsoever. And in the interim period,
what were they doing? What was their job?
They're officials. I mean, like they're like secretariat staff for the different committees.
Yeah.
They're experts in economics or in agriculture or in environment. I mean, they don't work for individual political representatives. They work for the group as a research and resource.
Okay,
quit. Civil service, a bit like a civil service. But so the ECR group, the European Conservative Reform Group, of which Frank Barrett, who's another Irishman, was the Secretary General, approached me and said, "Would I be interested in joining their group?" And I said, "Well, look, not really," I said, "but I have three Irish people that the Liberal group won't give contracts to. If you can guarantee me that they can get contracts and that they'd be given contracts for the term of the Parliament," I said, "I'd consider it." So they said, "Yes, we will." So I went back to the Liberal group and went back to Micheál Martin, explained this offer had been made and could the Liberal group improve their offer, and they refused. So I made the decision. And I took a principled stand to defend Irish people's interests, and I will do it again and again and again.
Well, within reason, I would hope so. But I'm looking at a quote from Micheál Martin at the time, and he described the party at the time as racist, xenophobic and homophobic. And, I mean, it's all very well, and everybody will appreciate somebody getting a job, but not if you're joining up with racist, xenophobes and homophobes.
Well, again, let me deal with that head on. I mean, I found that personally insulting that Micheál Martin or anybody else would think that I would be associated in any way with that. Just let me explain about the European Conservative Reform Group within the European Parliament. It's the third biggest group within the Parliament. It has 75 members from 19 countries. The president of the group is a Guyanian, the son of a Guyanian immigrant who's a practicing Muslim. The group has the highest percentage of Muslims within any political group in the European Parliament. It has the highest number, a percentage of non-white members of the European Parliament. It has very devout Catholics. It has very devout atheists. It has very devout Protestants. It also has people who are agnostics. It has people who are openly homosexual, the people who are very nationalistic, people who are against the euro and so on.
Have you discussed all this with them?
Yes.
Every one of them?
Yes.
All right. From the bed?
Yes.
Right.
But some of them I would have known before the parliament, before from previous parliaments. Because they were elected previously as well. I would have known some of them for years and years.
So why do you
think... Some of them would have been in the Liberal group that Fianna Fáil were aligned to, that moved from the Liberal group to the ECR group when I moved.
Well, why would you think that Micheál Martin and, in fairness, the party decided they couldn't stick this and that's the words they were using? Those are the words they were using. Sorry.
I can only speak on behalf of myself. I can't speak on behalf of other people we're thinking. I mean, obviously, I went against the party rule as regards being a member of the Liberal group. But under the rules of the European Parliament, you don't join as a political party, you join as an individual member. Each individual member has to sign a piece of paper committing to be a member of that political group, not the political party in Dublin or in London or in Berlin or in Paris or Italy.
Of course, but practice is...
No, but practice is that every single member has to sign a piece of paper saying, I will be part of this political group. You have to put your name down on a piece of paper
right.
Individually. Not the stamp of the official stamp of the party in Riga or in Vilnius or whatever else.
But is it not, and this is a genuine question,
yeah.
Is it not common practice that people have an association, affiliation with their own political parties back in the home country?
Yes, of course, I still am. I'm still a member of the Fianna Fáil party.
But you're not a member of the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party?
No, I was expelled from the Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party.
How did that go down with you?
Well, I was disappointed I wasn't allowed to make a case for why I did what I did, but that's the decision of the party leader. I can't... Again, I don't hold... As I said earlier on about other people, I don't hold any grudges.
Right.
Life is too short. Well, and in fairness, Micheál Martin has a job to do. He took a decision as a party leader, which he was entitled to do.
Right.
And, you know, you just have to accept it and get on. Move on. It hasn't changed my philosophy. It hasn't changed my desire to see Fianna Fáil doing well. It hasn't changed my pride as being called a Fianna Fáil member.
And tell me, what kinds of discussions did the pair of you have when you really wanted to run for the presidency?
Well, I felt that that Fianna Fáil should stand a candidate for the presidency. And that if nobody else was willing, I was willing to put my name forward and go for it.
Because you had discussed it even with Bertie Ahern, hadn't you, when you were too young?
That was more in jest rather than in serious because I was too young. But I went to Micheál and I said we should stand a candidate. No, it was a very difficult time because of the election and everything. The
this
general
is
election,
2011.
2011, when yeah. Fianna Fáil had suffered a huge defeat in the general election previously, and there was a lot of soul searching and a lot of wounded soldiers around there. But I felt that we could make a good effort and that we could put in a good campaign if we had the right candidate. And if nobody else was willing to go forward, I was willing to go forward.
Yeah.
Micheál Martin took the decision that they weren't going to stand a candidate. So I said, okay, grand, that's the decision. Well and good.
You didn't try and persuade him.
I did.
Oh,
I tried to persuade him, but he didn't change his opinion and said they wouldn't be standing a candidate. It's only shortly after I tried to persuade him and said that he made his final decision he wouldn't be standing a candidate, that word came out that he or somebody on his behalf had approached one of your former colleagues from RT to stand as the candidate.
Is this the Gay Byrne one?
Yeah.
I'd say that must have stuck in your craw a tiny little bit.
Well, after that, then I wrote to all the parliamentary party members and said, as we've now seemed to have changed our decision that we won't be standing a candidate, we're still looking for candidates, I'd be interested in putting my name forward.
And then what happened?
They decided not to, and that's it.
Well, was there to-ing and fro-ing between you and any other members of the party?
Oh, yeah, well, I've spoken to a lot of them, because some of my other colleagues in the parliamentary party at the time were interested in standing for the presidency as well.
Who were they?
Mary White was one, Eamon O'Keefe was also talking about it, and Ned O'Sullivan was also talking about it. Because, like me, they felt that we should stand a candidate.
Right. And you have, with some justification, pride in your ability to get votes.
It's not pride. I mean, I get votes because I have a great team of people around me and that they do tremendous work, and that over the years, the relationships that I've built up with people and the work that I've been doing on the ground has helped to maintain that. And I mean, it's not me. I'm only part of it. If I didn't have the people around me and the teams around me that helped me in every part of the country, I wouldn't have to do what I'm doing.
I was reading up on my brief and various bits and pieces about you yesterday, and I heard you were introduced at a particular gathering in Kerry as the second sexiest man in Ireland. So that's not the team.
Well, that was Dahi O'Shea speaking about himself.
Well, the implication was that he was the most...
I leave that up to the listeners to decide.
Okay. So, anyway, it's nice to hear modest remarks, but clearly you are a very good vote-getter. Now, you bumped into Micheál Martin yesterday. How did that go?
Very good. I went very well. I thanked him for his... because he made a very generous statement after my press conference yesterday. About my service and what I'd done, and I appreciated that, and I thanked them for that and wished them well for the future, and that I'd give support to whatever candidate the party picks in the future to stand for Europe.
That's it?
Yeah.
Tone?
No, very friendly. Again, I mean, as I said to you, I don't hold any grudge. Micheál Martin is a human being. He's a wife, he has children, he has families, he has friends, he has his own supporters. Like, why should I hold it? If you think grudge, if you think negativity affects me, why would I expand that negativity onto somebody else? Or somebody else's family?
Right.
I hold absolutely no grudge whatsoever against anybody in my political life, or hopefully in my private life as well.
Right. Though you wouldn't be human if you didn't have some regrets and...
regret what? I mean, do I regret...
being fired out of the parliamentary party?
But sorry, I was expelled from the parliamentary party. I could go back in if I do something or whatever. That could change.
Right.
But I mean, the reality is, I mean, do I regret the fact that I was meeting with my friends in April 17th, 1980 when I fell off the roof of the building? I don't regret that. I'm upset that it happened, but I wish it didn't happen.
Yeah.
But life goes on. You make the best of what you have. And if you carry around all this extra baggage, Richard, it will only drag you down.
Well, I think many people will understand that because, I mean, I didn't go into it, but you also had the loss of your brother.
That's right, Flor. I mean, Flor, and again, I mean, if it wasn't for my own family and the support that we can give each other, Flor died 9 years ago in a car accident, tragically, and his wife, and Aideen, and his three girls, Ruth, Grace and Sarah, with him in the car. And fortunately, they escaped without any physical injury. Now, of course, mentally and psychologically, it affects them more than anybody else affects them. But if you saw those three girls today, their mother has done such a wonderful job in rearing three beautiful women who are bright, who are vibrant, who are sparkling, who are full of energy, full of hope, full of laughter. And likewise with my other nephews and nieces, Brian and Niamh, with Blanet and Dervlin and Finan down in Kerry, and with Finan and Oisín and Sarica over in England. If I didn't have all of them, life, you know, that's what makes my life worthwhile, the fun and the joy that they bring me.
Okay. Listen, can I go through a few more calls for you?
Could I just make one more point, if you don't mind, in case we run out of time and forget it, but I just want to say about the care and attention I got when I was in hospital from the nursing staff, from the cleaners, from the care assistants, from the porters, from the catering staff, from the doctors, from everybody from top to bottom. I know there's so much criticism of the health service, but it was phenomenal what I saw inside there, the care and attention given to everybody. And I'm going to make a very strong political point. I apologise for doing this in yours, because I shouldn't be doing it, I know, but I feel I have to. When I hear people criticising nurses saying they're not working, in my 3.5 years in the hospital, I saw hundreds of student nurses finishing up their courses, heading off to England or to Australia or to Canada, because there was no jobs for them in Ireland. And the reality is that we're not treating our best and our brightest. Not saying anything against the people who are already there who are staying here, but we're not treating the others that we're training and giving them an opportunity. They could make things fantastic if we give them a break and give them the chance.
Okay. Okay, and I'm sure they will very much appreciate your saying that. Now, another caller was on. Marion, I worked with Aer Lingus and had the privilege of meeting Brian when he commuted to and from Brussels. Never met a more charming and patient person. Regularly waited to be taken off aircraft in his wheelchair when everyone else had left, and did it with such good grace. Pleasure to have him on board. I send him my best wishes. Another great to hear, Brian. What that man has suffered. I've fond memories of Brian playing music in our bar in Skibbereen as a young lad many years ago, and I wish him well, and that's from Brendan McCarthy. Brian Crowley's answer only begs the question, why are we paying expenses for MEPs to be present in Europe if they can work from a hospital bed? And that's from Pauline. Well, I suppose, Pauline, you don't get sick on purpose. And people get sick, and that's as simple as that. Another caller says very sceptically, we've no evidence that Brian Crowley did put down questions, amendments, etc. Voting is absolutely essential from an electorate's point of view. Is Brian saying his experience and longevity means he's exempt from the core aspects of the job? That's a tough one.
No, I'm not. And I mean, again, I'm sorry, just to deal with the question of the issue, but we don't know that whether he put down questions or not. That's public record.
Okay.
They're all there on the public record, the questions I put down to the Commission, to the Council, the amendments I put down to reports and so on.
Okay. And is he saying his experience and longevity means he's exempt from the...
No, I don't. I think, I mean, as I said at the outset, I wanted to be there. I want to be voting. But, you know, I want to be part of the debate. I want to be part of the discussion to fight my corner in face head on, as I try to do with every part of my life. But unfortunately, because of circumstances, I couldn't be there for that period of time, but I will be there in the future.
Okay. Another caller, a number of them, so I won't go through them, saying if it's so easy and effective to do the job remotely, why in God's name are we paying huge expenses? As you can imagine, that has come in quite a lot. Another caller was on. That man in 2003 flew from Strasbourg late one Friday, drove to the end of West Cork to launch a community project for us in Goline. What a man. And that comes from Connie in West Cork, and others saying, you know, cut the man slack, and others saying, hope you'll recover someday and take the job in the Oris. So on those positive notes, to quote yourself, thank you very much indeed for coming in and talking to us. I wish you good health, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Marion. It was a pleasure.